Hey gang, we all know Spotify has become the ultimate app destination for music lovers. I have an account and I love it. I find new music by following Tastemaker playlists, and I make my own playlist that I share featuring music from guests that have been on the show. But did you know that aside from millions of songs, Spotify now has all of your favorite podcasts, including How Did I Get Here? Yes, all of your podcasts are available on Spotify. Just go to Spotify.com or download the app from your app store, and don't forget to follow How Did I Get Here? That's Spotify. Millions of songs, thousands of podcasts. Let's get down. Hey gang, it's Johnny. I just want to take a second to talk to you guys about engagement. Right now you're listening to the show, and I'm not sure exactly what platform you're listening to it on. But whatever platform you're listening to it on, you can subscribe to it and get an alert every time a new show drops, usually every Tuesday and every Friday. New shows every Tuesday and every Friday. Whatever platform you're listening on, be it Apple Podcasts, Spotify, TuneIn, Overcast, Stitcher, any platform, you can subscribe to it. And if you can leave a comment, leave a star, share it on your social media if it's something that you like, please do that. We encourage you to do that. And also, as far as social media goes, you can follow me on Instagram and Twitter. I am at Johnny Gowdy on Instagram and Twitter. Give us a follow. All I want to say is, you like a show, share it, use the hashtag How Did I Get Here Pod. We'll give you a shout out. Thank you so much for listening to the show and engage. Let's get down.
And you may ask yourself,
how did I get here? And now here is your host, Johnny Gowdy.
All right, hello, I'm Johnny, I'm your host, welcome to the show. I hope you guys have all had a good week, whatever it is you did this week. I've had a good week, it was really great. I gotta tell you, that show Wednesday night at Antone's, Zach Lowe's 40th birthday bash, was just a love fest. Like, I haven't experienced in a long time, man. I mean, I walked into the thing like about an hour after it started. And it was a thing that went from like 8 to 2 in the morning, 8 p.m. to 2 in the morning. And so I got there at around 9 or so, ran into just a shitload of friends walking into the place, like people I haven't seen in years. It was great. Catching up with people backstage hang was unbelievable. The show was fantastic. Everybody that played, it was great to see Rachel Vett play from the Vets. It was great to see all the Dames Violet guys again. I've known all those guys since they were kids. Their drummer Tommy, I've known him since the early 90s when he was like 10 years old or something. Fantastic. Just what a great, great night. And our set was fantastic, man. Like, we played with this guy, Robin Diaz, who played with Smashing Pumpkins and Courtney Love. He was a guy playing drums. We had never played with him before. Zach, you know, we've known Zach Loy for years, me and Anar. And he played guitar. So, but we didn't go over the songs together. We just played them live on stage, three songs. Man, it was blistering. It was awesome. It was fucking fire. It was loud. It was cool. It was so much fun getting to play with Zach and getting to play with Robin Diaz and getting to play with my old friend Anar. Getting to play those old Gowdy songs was fun. Alpha Rev played. Endosheen did a reunion set that was very sweet, very emotional. They raised a lot of money for Takira Rose, Casey McPherson's daughter's foundation, his foundation for his daughter that he set up, which, by the way, you should go out and check out and give some money to it. She has a very rare disease where I can't really explain it because I'm not really authoritative enough, but it's a bad disease, and it's going to take her from the family if it's not stopped. So they're doing everything they can with research and raising money to get more research done. So Takira Rose Foundation, get out there and check it out. Anyway, what a great night, man. What a great night. I stayed until 2, man. I stayed until the end of the thing. Hanging out backstage, talking to people I haven't seen in years, meeting some new people. It was just a night of great love and fun. I'm glad it was a success, and I'm glad it was so fun, and I'm glad that we played so well and had such a great night. Anyway, I want to thank Zach Loy. Wish him a happy birthday. He's 40. I can't believe he's 40. I've known the guy since he was 15. Oh, lordy, lordy, look who's 40. Gang, I have a great show for you today. The amazing singer-songwriter Josh Rouse is my guest on the show today. Now, I first heard Josh Rouse in 2006. I was on tour with this guy, Taylor Davis, just me and him. We were cruising around the United States in a Toyota Matrix. And and he turned me on to a bunch of new music. But one of the things that we listened to almost on a daily basis was this Josh Rouse album called 1972. Great, great, great record. A record from the year he was born. He's just a great songwriter. Amazing, amazing singer. He's got such a great... great voice. Anyway, he's got a brand new album coming out on July 29th on Yep Rock Records. It's called Going Places. There are two singles out now, one called Stick Around, and one called Hollow Moon, which I will play for you here on the show. He's also going on tour of the Northeast on June 22nd through June 30th, doing all the Northeast places. He's even starting it out at Jam and Java in Virginia, which is where me and Taylor played on that tour. That was one of the places we played. So funny. Anyway, great conversation with Josh Rouse. He's been living in between Nashville and he was living in Spain for a while. He recorded this record Going Places in Spain. His wife, I think, is from there. And anyway, he was about to leave out and start going and, you know, getting ready to do this tour when I talked to him. And it was really, really exciting getting to talk to this amazing artist, Josh Rouse. So enjoy it. This is me and Josh Rouse chatting it up. Let's get down. Where are
air
you?
Air conditioner stories. I'm in Nashville.
Okay. Do you live there now, or?
Yes, yes. My family and I moved here, back here in September. Oh, okay. I'm sure you heard that I was in Spain, which
yes.
I have been in Spain a long time. And during the pandemic, I was there. So now I'm back in Nashville.
Awesome. Well, how do you like it? Did you leave because America got weird? Is that why?
No, I moved to Spain actually. Well, yeah, 18 years ago.
Okay. It was weird then too.
It's just it keeps getting weirder.
Yeah. Remember when that was as weird as it got? That was.
Yeah. Everyone asked me to explain George Bush 18 years ago and now I can't explain anymore.
No, he's like a nice painter guy now.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
It's weird that we live in a time where I don't know if we long for the times of Dick Cheney, but at least that was something you could wrap your head around as opposed to whatever this,
right.
It's just so discombobulated.
Yeah.
So I'm a musician as well. I live in Austin. And I first connected with your music in like 2006. I went on tour with this dude, just me and this other guy doing an acoustic tour around the States. And he played me your album 1972. And I fell in love with it. Like, we used to listen to it every day. And then after that tour was over, mm-hmm. I would put it on. But then I got the record Nashville. I remember when I got back from that tour. And then I just kind of like fell. I lost touch, you know how like you go a different direction. But I was so like, when I got the email from your publicist, I was like, I love that guy. And so going back and catching up what you've been doing for the last like 17 years has been fantastic. And this record Going Places is awesome. It's fucking great.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you moved to Spain 18 years ago.
In 2004.
2004. Yeah. Okay.
I haven't been there the whole time.
Okay. That, you moved there because your wife is from there?
And yeah, no, yeah, but I wasn't with my wife at that point.
Okay.
I mean, we were talking and I said, hey, I'd love to live in Spain. Could you rent an apartment for me? Or I'd love to try it out. So I just went there for a few months and fell in love and ended up staying long, coming in and out and touring. And the Nashville record came out.
Right.
And I toured for that. So I was in and out of Spain for about a year and then stayed there for another year. And then we moved to Brooklyn for a few years, went back to Spain. So it's been kind of in and out.
How, How was that? I like the way, there's a lot of people that say like, and then I moved to Brooklyn for a couple years. There's like this, like I tried to go do that there and it just didn't work out. It didn't take.
Well, we had our first child. My wife became pregnant and we thought Spain's probably the best place to handle having a new child in the world. So not kind of, you know, we were pretty solitary there in Brooklyn. I mean, we didn't have any family or any help or anything. And I was still, you know, well, I still am, you know, the life of a musician, you have to tour and be away sometimes. So,
yeah. Yeah. So you obviously, like everyone else, had some time off from 2020 on to do some stuff. And that's mm-hmm. when you put this record together.
Yeah. Yeah. It came about, I did another record, like a side project called Isla, uh-huh. which is an electronic thing. And I consider that kind of something that just came about. I was in the studio by myself a lot, and I came up with this thing that sounded, you know, I'm just being experimental, coming up with whatever I could every day, and I came up with something cool. And I had some more, I guess, what you could identify as Josh Rouse songs
right.
that I had been working on. And I took them to, I have a Spanish band that they live in Valencia. And we've been playing together for about 9 or 10 years. And they have a studio there that's been kind of my studio too. I've recorded a lot of things there. And they also, two of them, opened up a music venue, a small one. It seats about 50 people, but it's got a cool little stage in the corner. And so we went there in June of 2022, and I said, hey, I've just been working on some songs. Let's get together and play them. I didn't have any plans on recording them. The idea was just to, you know, invent a new band and play there. We'll be the house band for this place when it can open back up. And
right.
Here's a couple originals I have, and we were working on covers and things like that. But so that was four or five of the songs that are on this record. And then everything kind of closed back down again. And in the spring of 2021, I said, hey, do you want to record some of those songs that we were playing? I have some voice memos of us rehearsing them, and they sound great. I mean, we can either record them in your bar or go in the studio. So that's how this record came about. Very casual, very, you know, it was meant to kind of play in a small setting like that with a band, and you can really tap your toes to it, you know.
Yeah.
Nothing too deep. Very, very simple songs that you would want to hear in a bar if you went out.
Yeah, yeah. And the singles that people can hear now, the Stick Around and Hollow Moon, both amazing songs. I love the horns on Stick Around.
Yeah.
Did you get the horn guys to write it, or did you just, because that's a pretty, like, it's a very how would you say this? Like the horn line itself is familiar. It's ingrained in like if I had to put horns on something like that on a song, I would have come up with something very similar to that line, you know?
Right. A guy named Jim Hoke did it, and I had the song done. I wasn't sure the song was going to go on the record. I liked it. It reminded me, before it had horns on it, it reminded me of, I don't know, the guitar line almost to me had like a British folk rock, like a Fairport Convention sound to it or something. Meets something else, or meets J.J. Cale or something, you know? There's like Southern and Brit thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I liked it. And then I told Jim, hey, you want to try some saxes on this? And he came up with a part, and he put like a Memphis, he put like a Memphis sax part. So it's definitely, it has a lot, there's a lot in the pot, but it turned out, you know, it sounds good.
Yeah. Yeah. And
I liked it. I did. Yeah.
Oh no, go ahead.
No, I liked it. And I said, you know, I think I will throw this on the record. I think this turned out good. So.
Yeah. Man, I'm a huge fan of not just your songs and your melodies, but your voice is so soothing sounding.
Oh, thank you.
In a good way, like not like a weird, like whatever. There's a mellow tone to your voice that really just sits so well in the songs.
All right. Well, thank you.
Yeah. How did you're from Nebraska, right?
Right.
How long were you there?
Until I was 12.
Oh, okay.
I moved.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. Oh, and then I moved with my mother, and we went to California and Wyoming. And then I moved in with my father when I was a teenager, and we lived in Georgia. And then I ended up here in Tennessee, and I finished high school and went to college here in Tennessee, about an hour outside of Nashville.
Okay. So you did move around quite a bit as a kid.
Yeah.
Are you an only child? Or
I am.
Yeah. So is that what music became your friend? Did you live in a world? Because yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, my existence in Nebraska until I was about 12 was we lived in a trailer about 8 miles outside of a small town of about 500 people. And I was an only child. And, you know, my mother, my stepfather would come home at, you know, 5 or 6 in the evening, but I was home, you know, the bus would drop me off and I was home. So I was definitely a lonely coyote out there. And, you know, I had an 8-track player with Carole King's Tapestry and Saturday Night Fever, you know, and I still hear that stuff in my music. That's probably, you know, you could probably hear it too if I tell you that.
Yeah.
Yep. Chordally, harmonically, that stuff was ingrained in me and it's still in there. So
yeah, that's funny. You know, that's the connection that I had with that when I first heard that 1972 album and then came back from that tour. I listened to that album in the same times that I would listen to Tapestry. Does that make sense? Like I would listen to it on a Sunday morning while I'm making dinner. Singing along. Yeah.
Yeah. It's that thing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's that mood.
So,
definitely.
So, how did you find music and how did it find you to be like, hey, this is like, how did you get an instrument? Did someone tell you you're going to play an instrument or did you ask for it?
Well, I was in Nebraska till I was 12, except for 1 year, the fourth grade, we moved to, Salt Lake City. And I started violin in the fourth grade. I did it for a year. Everyone quit except me. I stuck with it. And then when we went back to Nebraska, there in public schools, you can start. It was kind of a mandatory. It was a class that you played. There was a band class. So I picked up the trombone and I played that till I was about in the eighth grade until it wasn't cool anymore. So when I started high school, I got an electric guitar and my uncle played. My uncle played in bands. His father played in bars around Nebraska, Quonsets, you know, would do dances, played country and Western, and my uncle did blues. So I was around it a bit. It's in my genes, I guess you could say. And, you know, I was like everyone else. I was a kid. I was into, you know, I mean, all I really had at that point in Nebraska was, you know, FM radio, AM radio, which was a big influence. And, you know, a vinyl collection. My stepfather, you know, collected vinyl, but it was still commercial music. There wasn't anything, you know.
Right.
Dr. Hook was probably as deep as it got, you know.
There's nothing like Dr. Hook, baby.
Yeah.
That was the name. That wasn't the guy's name with the eye patch, right? Although it seemed like it should be. That was the name of the band.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, he had a song called Sexy Eyes, Getting Down, you know, like kind of disco singer-songwritery stuff. Yeah.
So you did all that stuff, and when did you get with the guitar? And
I think it was a sophomore. I asked I had moved into my father. I'd been living with him for a year, and he was in the military. And I asked him if I could, you know, if we could go to a pawn shop and I could get an electric guitar. And, you know, I got a $25 guitar and just started playing it and playing in bands with my friends. And that's how it started. And, it, you know, at that point in my life, I had, you know, moving to California after Nebraska, you know, I think there was more exposure to, you know, I was exposed to the Cure the Violent Femmes stuff that was outside of commercial music, you know, you know, 6th generation cassette copies of, you know, the Dead Kennedys or whatever it was different. You know, like, oh, this is so great. You know? And then I was able to discover some more music, getting out of that environment and moving around, meeting different kids, and different people. So
it's funny. We're relatively the same age and there was sort of that hunger. I mean, you see it happen because all that music became the mainstream a few years later. You know, you never thought of REM as selling like 15 million albums. You know, back when you right. first heard REM, you weren't listening to Murmur thinking like, oh, this right. is going to be the biggest band in the world.
No, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
That was a very exciting time for music. And I wonder, I mean, you have kids. I don't know how old they are, but they are they old enough to like find music on their
13,
own?
They're 13 and 11. Yeah, they have playlists on Spotify. Mm-hmm.
But like back then, like it was, unless you knew a guy at the record store, or unless you stayed up all night watching the sort of like midnight to 6 a.m. version of MTV where you'd see some shit you couldn't believe. You know what I mean?
Right.
You didn't really get that stuff.
You
was
weren't
like
exposed
hunt.
To it.
Yeah.
You weren't exposed. Yeah, there was no way to get exposure to it. Now it's just all out there.
Yeah. You know? And especially, where did you live in California?
Northern California. Okay. It's outside of, yeah.
I lived in Marin County as a kid for like a year.
Oh, yeah, that's nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was in the 70s. It was kind of like, but that's like where there was like a college station that we got in. I remember my friends and I hearing God Save the Queen by the Sex Pistols, like when it came out, and thinking it was like, not thinking of it as like intimidating in any way or violent or angry. We just thought it was very, very funny. Like we thought those guys were very, very funny.
Yeah. We did too. I was the same way. And I remember in high school when the Dead Milkmen came out, we loved that band. Yeah. We just thought it was, that was high school humor. We just thought they were geniuses.
Yeah. You know?
And it was very melodic too. So,
yeah. So you went to college in Tennessee and
yes.
were you like playing
in Clarksville?
In Clarksville. That's when did you start playing out and stuff?
Yes. I played frat houses. I played Battle of the Bands here in Nashville. we'd take any gig we could get,
yeah.
you know, and they were original songs. We'd do a few covers, but they were mostly my, so I was songwriting at that point. I wasn't the singer the whole time. We had different singers. I did sing for a while. And yeah, then that ended in college. Yeah.
Wow.
But I noticed at that point that I had more, I guess because I was writing the songs and I was trying to get everyone together. I mean, everyone wanted to do it. We rehearsed and I was like, we got to get a manager. I kind of felt like I wanted to take it further than, you know,
yeah,
just a hobby.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was more passionate. My passion for it was, I noticed it was stronger than the other guys I played with.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
I have distinct memories of
and
that,
I think that's
that
what,
feeling. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. And living so close to Nashville, which is a music town.
Right.
I mean, I started coming to shows here in high school that were, you know, not country music. The industry, you know, the country music industry was here, but also there was, you know, there's always been a pretty healthy underground scene here in Nashville because of all the industry. They're all
so,
the kids
yeah.
of all the country music people, you know, yeah. that hated country music. So they started punk bands. So that it was heavy here. So we used to play here. I used to come to shows here. And I think it's because of living so close to Nashville that I thought, you know what, I could do, somehow I'm going to make a living with music.
Right.
You know, whether it be, I'd love to be able to, you know, be in a band or produce or do whatever. But I think because I live so close to Nashville's and I came here, I think that planted the seed that, you know, there's other people doing this. I can do it.
Yeah.
And make money at it somehow.
So how did you take those steps? Because eventually you got signed to a label, what, Columbia?
Rykodisc.
Okay.
Rykodisc, yeah. I was about to hang it up. I was 23 or 24, and I'd been
washed up.
Yeah, and, you know, I was kind of, you know, my parents were like, look, this has been great, you know, but and I've been valet parking cars, doing all kinds of, you know, tip jobs to pay the rent here in Nashville, living here and playing in bands. The bands didn't work out or we broke up or we tried to get a record deal. It didn't happen. And I said, you know what, I'm going to do something on my own. So I went in with a drummer I've been playing with for a long time. He was working on a studio. He did construction. I recorded 3 or 4 songs. He gave it to some people he met at a show and they said, hey, we love this. Do you mind if we send this to some people we know? And I said, sure, go ahead. And it was just a few months later, major labels were flying in to see me perform. One of those guys became my manager. So yeah, it had, that happened really quickly. And then I called all the, you know, my friends that I played with for years, you know, in bands and stuff. I said, I think I'm going to get a record deal. And they were like, what?
Yeah.
Remember? Said, yeah.
That was such a fucking thing. Like, oh, they're signed. I'm opening for this band and they're signed.
Yeah.
Like,
oh,
that was such a big deal. Yeah.
It didn't matter. Yeah. And but what happened? I was lucky. I was in the, you know, Nashville at that time. They weren't flying to Nebraska to see me perform.
Right, right.
There were other, I was part of, you know, there were probably a half a dozen singer-songwriters here who had interest from labels.
Right.
If they weren't already signed, majors, you know, CDs were being, you know, a lot of CDs were being sold. So they were signing a lot of new young talent, which I'm sure they still are, you know.
Yeah.
But they could make a big profit off CDs. So they were... I had friends that were getting like $300,000 on, you know, with Warner or whoever. And I was like, what? It's crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
And so there was definitely a signing spree going on in Nashville, and I became kind of part of that. And I ended up signing with an independent record label. Thanks to, I worked with a guy named Chris Moon. He was my manager at that point. He said, you know, because I didn't want to change anything.
Right. Yeah.
I did I started recording on an 8-track, and I said, I kind of want to do this. And he said, well, if you want to go major label, and we talked to him, they said, these are great demos, but you know, this is going to be a process.
Right.
And Rykodisc was like, we like this. We'll put this out and you won't get very much money, but we'll give you some tour support and you can do a grassroots thing. And we decided to do that. And it took some time, you know, it took some records, but it worked. And to some degree, you know, I still, 25 years later, I'm still doing it, so.
Yeah. I had some good friends that, do you remember the Buick McCain, Alejandro Escobedo's, like,
yeah,
rude, yeah, overly loud rock band? Around that same time, they were signed, yeah, to Rykodisc, and I remember them being very, very stoked on that. And I remember, yeah, Rykodisc had, like, Sugar, that Bob Mould band that was so cool.
They did. They had the band Morphine.
Yeah. What a great
band. They had the Nick Drake records, which that really brought me in.
That's right. Yeah.
And yeah. So, and they were, yeah. Andrew Bird.
Oh, yeah.
At that,
yeah,
time,
yeah,
who really, no one really knew him. He was doing, it was called Andrew Bird's Bowl of Fire. And I think he had been playing the Squirrel Nut Zippers. So,
what?
But they were, you know, they were great to work. I did 5 records with them. They,
wow,
were great to work with, and they were bought and sold a couple times. Island Record, Chris Blackwell bought the company for a while. That was great too. I enjoyed that. So they changed hands. You know, there was some different presidents in there, but I'm grateful to them for, you know, helping me develop my career.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause you know, it takes that. Cause you went from like some dude in college that's like recording your stuff on an 8-track, and that's what you're comfortable
A-track.
To have thrown you into like a thing with, like, you know, God, whoever, some Lord Algae
was producing.
Put you through.
And that's what they would have wanted to do.
Right.
Yeah.
It's funny. Cause you look back that, cause when I think of you, and I wrote down these names, I think of like Ron Sexsmith, Josh Ritter, Ed Harcourt, uh-huh, kind of this group of, uh-huh, of guys that were kindred spirits as like these singer-songwriters, yeah, but not like boring, like pop songwriters as,
right,
well.
Yeah, they're pop songs, but slightly, you know, maybe jazzier chords.
A little askew, yeah. You definitely,
exactly,
bring out of that, like you use broader chords than like a Ryan Adams, who's very like,
right,
G, C, D, A minor, yeah.
He is, yeah, yeah.
Which is nothing wrong with that. But you do, there's some more expensive chords going on in your stuff.
Yeah, harmonically, yeah, it's more pleasing to my ear to have chords with. I heard a guy play the other night, and he was playing, I'd never heard of him. He had some chord changes, kind of like mine. And it was pleasing to hear him come back, be on the other side and hear that coming back,
yeah,
at me. I was like, okay. I feel good about this, because sometimes you don't know what people, I'm so used to it that I've completely forgotten about it, you know, about a chord progression or a melody, you know, something harmonically that is similar to what I do.
Right.
And he was kind of doing something similar. And I thought, that sounds right.
Yeah, definitely.
Because you do, you know, you hear a lot of GCD and, And you could do a lot with those chords. And there's different, Dylan does it, and he's always able to do it in some way that's like, wow, how does he do that?
Well, there's another another great Nashville person I just had on, Mary Gaucher, who's she has no, she claims to have no musical abilities except for what she can do musically. Right. Yeah.
Right.
So being in Nashville like that, did you ever get into the system of like co-writes and like going to a thing from what 10 to 2, 2 to 5, or whatever it's called?
Well, no, never like a staff writer, but now that I get older, I'm contemplating. But I have co-written with people, just dates, you know, but never, I've never had a publishing deal that like required me to kind of do four or five a week. I enjoy it. Sometimes it works well. Mm-hmm. You know, I've had some really good, there was a guy that played in my band. His name is Daniel Tashin. He played in my band for a while and we started writing together. And I think he had co-written a little bit with people. And then, you know, the road really wasn't for him. But we wrote a few songs on the Nashville record together, and that worked really well. And we've continued to write together to this day. We still, you know, we'll do at least a few songs a year together.
Yeah.
And he's had some success with Casey Musgraves. He's co-written her big songs.
That's how I know his name.
You know.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he produces. So, and then so he went into that and has had some country success as well. And he's really good at it. That's a different. He obviously he's good at it because he's, you know, people want to play with him and he's had some success, but it's a different thing.
Yeah.
I suppose I could do it. It's I'm slower than he is.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
You know, you've got to be able to live with, you got to bash it out and go, okay, next song. That's fine. Maybe it's great. Maybe it's not. Yeah. And out of those 300 that you write in a year, there'll be 10 really good ones. I'm kind of the hippie spirit thing. It's like, if it's not hitting me, you know,
yeah,
this is for my own stuff. So I think I'm kind of attached to that, philosophy a little bit, that if I don't want to hear it again, or I don't want to come back to that song, then it's probably not very good.
Yeah.
And I've just wasted a bit of time.
Well, yeah, I always kind of look at it. Well, at least I was practicing writing.
That's true. Yeah. There's another thing that I do enjoy it, and I could do it because, I've noticed even within my own records and my own. So I think after the third or fourth record, I started becoming more of a crafts person. I got better at it. And, I could take something that an idea that I had and get it finished and it would sound good. You know, I could craft a song.
Yeah.
But that took till probably my third or fourth, I think, working with a guy named Brad Jones, who produced 1972, he helped me with all that. And working with people that were better at, you know, that they're good at crafting songs,
right?
You know, and Nashville's a great place for that. So once I got into that, I could do it, you know?
Yeah.
It wouldn't take me so long to finish a song.
Right.
You know?
You were saying, do you ever do any of those like songwriting games where you get a prompt? And you have a deadline, and there's a bunch of people have the same prompt, and they all have to turn in the song?
No, I know some people that do that, yeah. Are you part of one of those clubs?
I have been a bunch, and it's helped me out a lot. Do you know a guy that lives out there named Billy Harvey?
I do. Yeah, he came over here to my house. Yeah, we wrote a song together.
Yeah, he's a great songwriter.
He's really, and the song turned out really great. He's great at it. So that's one good thing about living in Nashville. You can talk to someone, go have a coffee and do a song. And it'll be, you know, something you could put on a record for sure.
I was in a bunch with him with a guy named Bob Schneider that he played with for a while.
Right.
And there's a whole group of like, there's like eight dudes that literally have like the same title songs on the records that they released in the same year.
Like
a bunch of us
him.
Have
oh,
a song
great.
Called Bad Man, and it's pretty funny. I would go back and like change the names afterwards to protect the innocent, so to speak. Anyway,
Here's a good idea. If you're going to do this in the future, you know, if you continue with that thing, is, like you said, well, it's got that song title, or these, there's all these people putting records out with the same song title. You know, you can always, you know, do one called Brown Eyed Girl.
That's true.
You know, the accounting in the music business, the accounting in the music business is not up to par, as you may know. So if you put that on a record, there's a chance.
Just make sure I'm affiliated with the same PRO as Van Morrison.
Maybe it has nothing to do with Brown Eyed Girl, the song, but yeah.
I've always threatened to write a song called Yesterday.
There you go.
So you were saying, now that you're getting older, you think more about writing more. And is that, there's a thing that I noticed that happened after 2020, like last year when I'd be talking to people on the show and even just friends of mine and people I'm in bands with and stuff, would kind of be like, well, hey, after this last year and a half, I kind of realized I don't have to be doing this all the time. You know what I mean? Like, I don't really want to be on the road all the time. I don't want to play as much as I used to. But then some people came out and they're like, I am going to put out 3 records a year and just tour. I'm getting rid of my place. I'm just going to, like, I'm doubling down. So some people pulled back the reins and some people doubled down. Where did you sit on that?
I created a lot during the pandemic. I was ready to play shows. We snuck a couple in Europe, in Spain last summer. And then in the fall I did some, and then just did some in April, but it's been difficult. I'm going to go back out in another week. It's difficult, getting out there again. It depends where you're playing, but I'm playing listening rooms or small clubs. So I think people in those venues are still having trouble. I was just in Austin. I was at the O4 Center or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
There weren't a lot of people, and I do well in Austin. And I think that's been going on around the board, just audiences, really, unless it's, you know, Phoebe Bridgers outside playing for 5,000 people,
right?
A singer songwriter, you know, depending where you are, I don't think that's come back yet.
That's kind of the dark side of having an enlightened audience, an intelligent and enlightened audience.
Yeah. totally. Yeah. So I'm, you know, I want to play. I don't want to be, I have, you know, 2 kids. I don't want to be out 100 dates a year. And I could, but the work wouldn't be very gratifying. You know, I'd be playing. I probably couldn't work that much, to be honest. And so usually my cycle is, you know, I'll do some shows when I'm in the States. I'll play around here as much as I can. When I'm going to go to Europe in the fall and do a tour. And I can play around there pretty steadily as well. But, you know, when you get older, traveling becomes harder.
Yeah.
Some of the gigs are great. Some of them are kind of like, it'd be great to be able to do this when I wanted to do it and have another, some other source. And I know a lot of people my age that have been doing it a while kind of find that as well. It's like, it'd be nice to have, you know, sell real estate on the side of something. But I've been so, my identity, everything I do is so, been so wrapped up in this for the past 25 years that it's hard for even people to see me in a different light, you know?
Yeah.
If I wanted to, you know, do something else and still do music, it's a tricky thing for me.
Right.
Unless I wanted to do something online, voiceover work. So, you know, but I'm still getting work and playing live and, which I enjoy, but, you know, it is a business of, it's a young man's game, the music business, and it will always be to some degree.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is weird to sort of like figure out a way to age gracefully in this business, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think I'm doing it. That's the thing. You want to work when you can and you need to work, but at the same time, you don't want to feel, and I have felt this. I'm sure y'all do. Even when I was younger, that you're doing stuff that I didn't get into it for this, or I don't feel good about this, but that's going to happen with any job, you know?
Yeah. Oh dude, I play in a cover band. And that's
no, but that's great,
dude.
Now,
it's great.
I would definitely, yeah.
But it sucks. You know what I mean?
I would go live in Key West and play Jack Johnson songs.
Me too.
And be happy as hell. Maybe I'll throw a couple originals in there, but I don't find any shame in that at all.
No, I mean,
I think you're doing the same thing. You're entertaining people and playing music.
Well, sure.
That's all I've ever really wanted to do.
And the one thing is that I can say that's great is I can finance making records and going to record. Like when I have it, I can go to a studio and hire all kinds of people that I want to because I'm not, playing for tips at a coffee shop, which I mean, there's nothing wrong with that, but it does make the whole trying to make this thing move a lot harder.
Right, yeah. Right. And, one thing about, as I get older, I contemplate doing, covers as well, or doing them more, because you learn a lot when you learn those songs.
Oh, yeah.
I did a project, I have a Patreon page, and I did a project last year, and it was called 1982, just kind of a spoof off of 1972, and where I did covers from. So I investigated, the pop charts in 1982, and they were incredible. The songs, the chord changes.
That's the year I started my first band.
So I did a bunch of...
Sorry. My first band.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. So go ahead. Sorry.
So I learned a bunch of those songs and recorded them, and getting under the hood of those songs really, you learn.
Yeah.
And I think I can bring some of that stuff into my, little tricks or just even chord progressions, someone else's material that you like and that is of your taste. You can always learn something from that, and it can help your own, maybe broaden your palate a bit.
Yeah. And like the writing the songs that you don't really like, at least you're writing a song and not, whatever, doing something destructive to yourself, doing blow. With hookers or something.
Right?
Yeah. Curious, what songs did you do for that 1982 album?
Oh, I have to think. I did everything from The Clash to some rare stuff like Orange Juice, that Scottish band.
I heard the Rock the Casbah.
The Casbah, which is what a cool, I'd always liked that song as a kid, and what a cool chord progression in it.
Oh, yeah.
Lyrically, everything. It's just a cool song.
That drummer is the piano guy. Isn't that Topper?
Oh, really? Topper Hinton, yeah.
Yeah.
He plays piano on that. He played the bass on that, too.
That song has, that piano part feels so good.
It's just groovy, man.
Yeah.
And the bass line.
Yeah.
So I did some research on the song, and he plays a lot of that song.
Good.
I think they kind of left him in the studio, and after hours he's putting the bass and the piano and played the drums on it, and I think that was his thing. So I did a Flock of Seagulls song, which was ridiculous. I did
which did you just basically
somebody's
love song?
Baby. No, I did
Iran,
the bigger one that they had. Iran, yeah.
I fucking love Somebody's
and
Baby.
I did that. Somebody's Baby.
I
what
love
a great
that song.
So I learned
much.
That and how to change the key on it. Yeah, it's great. Great tune.
That the choice that they made.
Not,
oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, so it was mainly kind of pop chart stuff. A few things that people might not know. Yeah.
Yeah, dude. That the harmony on Somebody's Baby is to me like it's like melting butter. It's beautiful.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's just the pleasure principle is very high on that. That tune.
Jackson, man. Are you a big Jackson brother? Yeah. You're a 70s guy.
Yeah. I got to hang out. Yeah. I, in Barcelona, I was doing a festival and, he was there and we got to hang out. It was just him and I and my wife, and he bought out a bottle of tequila, and we talked for a few hours. Nice
How
moment.
Awesome, man. He seems like a really cool guy.
Yeah. He was. He was very humble and said that he was still, talk about aging gracefully. You meet people like this and they can inspire. Of course, he's in a different league as well because he's had hits.
Yeah. Yeah,
he's had a lot of hit songs. So yeah, he's someone that's definitely aged gracefully, and he said he was playing some, still playing, and you know, enjoying himself.
Yeah. I, the funny thing about this, and you were saying this earlier, that it's a young man's business, is you get better. And that's the part that kind of fucks with you, is like, you're like,
that sucks.
I'm so much better than when you guys thought I was the greatest thing. Like, what the fuck is
exactly,
wrong with you?
Exactly.
Such an odd.
But unless something tragic happens to you, or unless you create some kind of a story that the press can really run with, or, you know, there's some kind of a, or you go away for 30 years and make a big comeback. It's hard to put out a record every few years and keep fans interested, you know, or
keep yourself interested,
you know, play that game. What's that?
Keep yourself interested.
Sure. Sure.
I mean,
yeah.
I find that the hardest thing that the obstacle that I have is getting bored with myself as an artist as I get older.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's sort of a weird thing. I mean, it makes you rise to some other occasions and challenge yourself creatively and stuff like that.
Sure. Hey, sure.
So you're going on tour for a couple weeks, June 22nd through June 30th in the Northeast, and you're starting it at Jam and Java. I've played there a couple of times. That place is awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, I've only played there once, but I do like it.
Yeah. So you never did any kind of like you never did like traveling around in your car without having a record deal kind of thing, did you? Like acoustic guitar?
No, I did not tour until I had a record out.
That's a great way to start. I mean,
yeah, I like I said, I was very fortunate because Ryko Disc, they believed in what I was doing. They thought it was starting out maybe a bit indie. But they thought that there was more commercial potential there.
Right.
So they were flipping I went from my couch to going to England, touring over in Europe, and you know, they flipped the bill for that. And I was always able to bring a couple people with me, eventually a full band. And
that's awesome.
Yeah. And I got a great booking agent right off the bat. Frank Riley is his name.
Legend.
He put me out with, I was opening for Wilco and Ron Sexsmith and Amy Mann, Joe Henry. I had a team of people that believed in what I was doing, or, you know, they threw it out there and it stuck to some degree, I guess, because I'm still doing it, but they knew the right people to hook me up with, you know, the right, marketing, I guess you would say.
Yeah. So you said you're doing this tour. Are you doing the rest of the States? Are you coming back to Austin, or was that just?
I'll probably be back to Austin next year. I'm doing like a yearly Texas visit where I do the Kessler Theater.
Oh, nice. It's a great place.
In the Heights Theater.
I love that place.
And then Austin, I did the O4. That's the second time I played there.
I've never even been to the O4. Isn't that weird? And I live here.
Yeah. Well, it's new. I think I played it in 2020, right before the pandemic hit, and it was brand new at that point. Huh. So I think they opened up and were around for a few months, and then it got shut down.
Yeah.
So
that Heights Theater is a pretty awesome place. I play with the Bodines.
It's great.
Yeah, because they, you know, the guys, they split up.
What a cool band. I like that.
Oh, yeah. One of my favorite bands.
That was a good college rock. What a cool sound, too. It's such a unique sound.
Totally. They were like the Everly Brothers of the 80s. You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Josh, this has been great talking to you. And I'm sorry it's not in person. I hate this lag of like trying to have a conversation with someone you've never met on Zoom is just too weird. There's all this. No, go ahead. No, go ahead. I'm sorry. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Turns into a Canadian
thanks,
thing.
Yeah, man. It's nice.
Great talking to you. And I will definitely, if I'm in town and not playing next time you come to Austin, I will be there and I'll come up
thanks,
and say, hey, man, it's been really, really great talking to you.
Sure.
And thank you. And congratulations, man. This record Going Places is incredible. People can get out and hear the single Stick Around and Hollow Moon available now. The video for Hollow Moon is really beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah. Great job, Josh. Good meeting you. Have a good trip, bud.
Okay. Bye.
Somewhere on a magical night,
That was Josh Rouse. His album Going Places drops July 29th on Yep Rock Records. Check out his singles, Hollow Moon and Stick Around. You can also see him. He'll be on tour of the Northeast from June 22nd to June 30th. Get out to joshrouse.com for all of your Josh Rouse needs. What a great conversation. What a cool dude. And what a great artist. I'm so glad I reconnected with his music and connected with him. He's awesome. Awesome. Gang, don't forget when you're out there checking out joshrouse.com. You can subscribe to this podcast wherever it is that you find podcasts, be it Spotify, Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, Overcast, Stitcher, anywhere. New shows every Tuesday and every Friday. Thank you so much for listening to the show. Have a great weekend, whatever it is you're doing. Let's get down.
I've been confined to here. What will happen? I don't know. It's just days on days. Gotta get away from here. I'm dying to start again. It's just too hard for me now. Loneliness brings me to midnight. Under this hollow moon, I tell myself I'm alright. I figure out what to do. Hollow moon. Hollow moon. Just don't